State versus Brandu, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. And be Mr. Scott Carlson, an attorney from Sioux Falls for the appellant Brandu, and for the appellee State of South Dakota, Zan C. Meyer, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Carlson, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please this court, counsel. We are here today because on January 7th, 2005, Alamu Brandu was in his car in the Walmart parking lot about 10 o'clock at night. One of his co-workers at the time, Abraham Sandel, pulled up in his car, separate car, pulled into the parking lot, got out of his car. You can see clearly, very clearly from the security cameras of the Walmart parking lot, that just as Mr. Sandel started getting out from the line of cars, kind of where you can drive your car down the Walmart parking lot there, just as he started to clear that and walk towards the store, you could see my client, Mr. Brandu, start to drive his car towards Mr. Sandel. Clearly from the cameras, you can see Mr. Brandu drive, and he's getting closer and closer to Mr. Sandel as he's walking towards the store. The last minute, you can see Mr. Sandel sort of look over his shoulder, and it's not clear, real clear, but you can sort of see he turns, and he's wearing a bright yellow jumpsuit, and he starts to run. At that point, Mr. Brandu's car impacts Mr. Sandel. He goes up onto the hood of the car. You sort of lose sight of what happens at that point because of the camera angles. But then about the next thing you see is Mr. Brandu's car running into George Zahn's car, who was the second victim in this case. And his car is parked next to the Walmart parking lot store. He's waiting for his wife to come out of the store. And you see Mr. Brandu's car run into that car and pin it up against the building. So Mr. Zahn is unable to open his door. He's stuck inside his car. At that point, Mr. Brandu gets out of his car. Mr. Sandel, the person that was run over, is laying underneath the car. He's trapped underneath the car. And he gets out, steps over him, looks down at him, and then he walks off. Well, shortly after that, he was apprehended and arrested, charged with attempted murder, aggravated assault against Mr. Sandel, the person that he ran over with the car. He's also charged with aggravated assault Mr. George Zahn, the person that was sitting in his car waiting for his wife to come out. He was charged, we had a trial, he was convicted. We are here today because it is our argument that there was distinct separate acts in this case, there's not distinct separate acts. That what was set in motion, literally, the wheels were set in motion in this case when Mr. Brandu started that car, that it was one continuing transaction from the moment he started to drive his car, ran into Mr. Sandel, and then ran into Mr. Zahn. There is no distinct end to the first act, just as I don't believe there's a distinct beginning to when the next crime started. So,
are you conceding then that there was a crime committed here?
Yes.
What was that crime?
We are conceding that there was an aggravated assault crime committed on Mr. Sandel when my client ran into him with his car and ran him over, that was aggravated assault.
What about the other gentleman who was eventually found under the car?
Mr. Zahn. Mr. George Zahn was parked in his car, sort of in a no-parking area, just briefly waiting for his wife to come out of the store. It's our position that Mr. Brandu, he did run his car into there. But if I actually went to the scene of Walmart parking lot and looked at that, and there are pictures that were admitted at trial of these, of some posts. There were three metal posts that mark handicap parking signs, all right, very close to the store. Those posts are in a diagonal sort of area. They're about, I would say, 6 to 7 feet apart in between those. The state's own case, they argued that Mr. Brandu swerved, somehow made it through those posts to intentionally run into Mr. Zahn. It's our position that that's not what happened, that if you looked at those posts, if you look, which I did, and looked at that scene of where the impact happened with Mr. Sandel, or the person that was hit by the car, there's no way a person could purposely swerve through those posts. So it's our position that he didn't have even a general criminal intent to cause injury to Mr. Zahn in that car.
Did you get to argue this to the jury?
Yes, well, I did.
And the jury apparently didn't buy it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So is there, can we decide that as a question of, I mean, I guess what is our standard of review? It can't be a question of law.
Well, I frame that as a second issue, Your Honor. That's a very good question. I frame that as my second issue, abuse of discretion. That's sort of the standard of review, that the underlying judge, that the trial court abused their discretion by giving him a 15-year consecutive sentence for the aggravated assault on the person in the car, Mr. George Zahn. So I believe that you can look at that, yes.
So what you're saying is he can be convicted of both of them but not sentenced on both of them.
That's my position, yes.
What was his sentence on the conviction of Mr. Sandal?
He was convicted for the maximum, 25 years in prison for the attempted murder, and then he was convicted of the aggravated assault against Mr. Sandal where no sentence was imposed. So that brings up a very good point. So if the trial court really thought these were separate transactions, I think he could have given him 15 years on the aggravated assault for Mr. Sandal, but he didn't. He imposed no sentence and then gave him an additional 15 years for the assault charge conviction on Mr. Zahn, the person pinned against the car, and that was ran consecutive, so his total sentence was 40 years, 25 for the attempted murder, 15 for the aggravated assault.
Now, there's a testimony of an eyewitness. What did he have to say?
There was a number of eyewitnesses, Your Honor, that testified, and you'd be surprised when I started reading these police reports and was preparing for trial, there was quite a few people in that Walmart parking lot, 10 o'clock at night, on a cold January night, snow on the ground. One of the witnesses said that he could hear a car gunning it, that it sounded like when he heard this car that it, you know, the engine was very loud, like he was really gunning it. And you can see from the video there's quite a bit of smoke that's coming out of the exhaust pipe of the car. So to me that seemed like a very accurate description. Some of the other witnesses said that, you know, basically they saw this car driving at a high rate of speed. And, you know, there's a lot of them that saw Mr. Baranu get out of the car afterwards. Now, the state argued at trial that he ran from the scene, but the witnesses, some of them said, you know, he actually walked away from the scene, and then I think once he realized people were chasing him, then he started to run, but they tackled him a very short time later.
Was that his car he was driving?
Yes, yes. And he did not have a driver's license either.
If we were to... by your argument, then essentially, if someone was mad at someone in this pavilion today and they threw a bomb in here and four or five people were killed or injured, you're saying then that only the person that the perpetrator was after, he could only be sentenced for that and not for the other people that were hurt as a result? Of something like this?
But that's a very good point, Your Honor. I think what my argument is that there's got to be at least a minimal criminal intent. In the suggestion that you made, I think it's pretty clear if somebody were to throw a bomb into a crowded auditorium or somewhere else where you know there's more than one or two people, clearly there's the potential for many other people to get injured.
Well, what's the difference with the Walmart parking lot?
Well, that's a very good question. My argument is that I think you at least got to have a minimal intent. The way that this is charged is that Alamu Baranu attempted to cause bodily injury to another or knowingly caused it. Well, he didn't knowingly cause it, all right? So the question is, did he attempt to cause it? I think that the speed of his car was such, the roads were icy, even if he had wanted to stop, and I'm not arguing he tried to stop, but I'm arguing even if he wanted to stop, I don't think he could have. Somehow that car fit through those pillars. I mean, and the sides were both scraped. I mean, it was that tight. I just think that, you know, there's got to be at least a minimal criminal intent, even for the aggravated assault on Mr. Zahn, and I just don't think that's here.
He never did apply his brakes, did he? After he hit Mr. Sandal, he just kept going. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. In fact, the witnesses corroborated that. They said he never even tried to stop.
So how much further did he go after he ran over Mr. Sandal?
You know, I asked the officers that investigated that, how far was the travel? Nobody seemed to know. Nobody measured it. So I went out there and checked myself. I would say it was about 50 feet, roughly, from the point of impact of Mr. Sandal, where he hit the hood and was dragged underneath the car that entire time. Until it hit Mr. Zahn's car, it was about 50 feet.
So couldn't a jury reasonably infer that a person who's trying to run someone over in a parking lot and does that and then continues on at high speed without braking, couldn't they infer that he was knowingly attempting to hurt someone else too?
Yes, they could.
And that's apparently what the jury decided in this case.
Well, we don't know, because he was charged with attempting to cause or knowingly causing bodily injury to another with a dangerous or deadly weapon, the car, against Mr. Zahn. Jury's verdict doesn't specify, you know, they didn't circle which part, they just put an X in the guilty box.
Okay, have you completed your presentation?
Yes, I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. I'm not sure what happened to the argument that the defendant just presented about attempted first-degree murder. What we argued at trial was that the defendant attempted first-degree murder and tried to take the life of Sandahl. And that was because the defendant drove a dangerous weapon, his vehicle, through a busy parking lot. He didn't brake, he didn't stop, he didn't turn away. He wanted to get Sandahl. It was deliberate, and he ran him down. We also argued that this was, if you look at our closing argument in the transcripts, that this was a knowing crime with respect to the second victim, Zahn, because it's just a reasonable result to expect if you're driving through a busy parking lot that you're inevitably going to hit someone. And that's what we have here. And as far as these being the same transactions at sentencing, what Judge Severson found was that they were separate victims, separate collisions, and separate transactions. Not that they were the same transaction. I want to be clear about that. And we also have some pretty serious injuries to both of these victims. Not that our aggravated assault statute requires permanent injury, but both of these victims sustained very serious injuries, and they both had in their own way, they have to face this the rest of their lives. So does the court have any questions about?
Yeah, I guess I do. It seems like your argument kind of goes in circles a little bit. You say that the judge found that they were separate, and he's arguing that they were distinct. And are you arguing that there's completely separate acts to hurt the man in the car?
Yes. They're two different victims, two separate collisions, two separate criminal actions.
Okay, that's the result. But what differentiates or what shows then that it's just not a continuous strike or attempt at the fellow employee of his?
The first victim, he never brakes and he never turns and he never stops. The second victim, he's accelerating. He continues to go faster, and he swerves at the end and crashes into the second victim. And it doesn't necessarily imply that he was out of control, because everyone would know if you go through these handicapped parking, these posts that are out there, a tight fit like that, you're gonna have some problems maintaining your speed. And he kept accelerating. He never stopped. So
what testimony supported that?
Whose testimony supported the pillars?
No, supported the acceleration.
We have a number of witnesses who said it looked like he was accelerating. We have two eyewitnesses who were just happened to be there. We have Zahn himself. We also have the videotape. You can see he's not slowing down. He's continuing to go fast, and he's hitting another victim.
Did he testify in his own behalf?
No, he didn't. The defendant didn't take the stand.
Okay.
No, he did not.
I have a question about your legal argument on waiver, that the defendant waived the second issue because he did not raise objections. What do you, under that theory of waiver, how do you envision a defendant being able to, or when they should object, or how does that process work? I mean, normally as a judge, you're there, you sentence them, it's over with.
Mm-hmm.
They go to prison or they go to jail and the sheriff hauls them off. When are they supposed to object?
When the court imposes a sentence, what I would say is I need to make my record. I'm objecting to the length of this sentence, and I'm objecting to the fact that it's consecutive.
So every time, what you're saying, in order to preserve a challenge to the length of a sentence, every time a defendant is sentenced, they'll have to object at that time.
That's right. That's what this court's prior holdings say.
I understand that that's what we've said, but the logistics of it, it doesn't make sense to me that you're expecting them to, at the time of sentencing, after everything's over and done, they're going to object. I mean, truly, they object prior to the sentencing. They both get to argue. Isn't that enough to preserve it?
No, I don't think so. I think that's, we have to object at sentencing. We have a line of cases that say that. I know it's difficult for the defense attorneys. I've heard that argument made in the arguments that we do here. I've heard defense attorneys say, if I object, it's going to be worse. But nevertheless, that's your obligation to preserve your record. In this case, the standard isn't that you have an abuse of discretion. We've gone away from that standard about 8 or 6 years ago, forget 1998. And what we're looking at is whether this sentence is grossly disproportionate to this particular defendant's crime. In this case, whether the defendant objected or not, you still don't have a crime that's disproportionate to his crimes, to the injuries that he caused, and to the risk that he posed to the public. So any way you want to look at it, whether he didn't object or whether you want to look at it under the grossly disproportionate standard, we're still within the statutory maximum, and that sentencing analysis ends. But I do understand your point. It is difficult, but they have to object and preserve their record below.
The court gave two sentences, 25 years for attempted murder and 15 years for the aggravated assault on Mr. Zahn, and then made them consecutive. I mean, in other words, he had to serve one first and then serve the next. So he had to serve 40 years in the penitentiary.
That's correct.
And as I understand now, the argument that defense counsel is making today is that this was all one transaction. Running over one person was his intent, and the other one was simply an incidental act as part of his running over that other person. Mm-hmm. Suppose we accept that argument, that it was all one transaction. Does that mean that the court could not have given these consecutive sentences?
Well, if you found it was one transaction, what the concern is double jeopardy, meaning that you're not punishing someone twice for the same crime. But by the same token, the analysis is, if you have different victims and you have a separate collision and you have separate injuries, that we don't have one transaction. You can't just, with impunity, go out and, as Justice Sinner pointed out, injure 25 people in that parking lot and say, you know, the rest of you don't count. I only meant to hit one. If it's reasonably likely that it's going to occur and it's inevitable, you are still criminally responsible for that, and it's a separate act, a separate crime.
The court has the discretion to impose concurrent sentences. In other words, the court could have made the sentences to be served at the same time, which would have meant he would have only served 25 years, or the court has the discretion to stack them, to make them consecutive. And so I think counsel was saying there's an abuse of discretion here. And how do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, it's not an abuse of discretion standard. We use the grossly disproportionate test. And it is in the judge's discretion. This court doesn't micromanage sentences, like looking and seeing, well, maybe I would have done it differently. Judge Severson he was the person there who heard the trial, and he's the one who makes that call. We don't second-guess the judge who sat through that sentencing hearing and heard all the defendant's lies and heard all the facts about how this was two separate collisions. You accept the discretion of that judge with due deference to the legislature on the amount and the different sentences that can be imposed. I hope that answers your question on that. Were there any other questions? We'd ask that you affirm the defendant's convictions and sentences in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Mr. Carlson, you may have rebuttal. It's 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think if this court were to look at the Sealer case, in that case, the ruling was, it sort of helped define what distinct separate acts are, because there's no statutory sort of definition of it. In the Sealer case, there were some crimes that were committed, and that court, and this court found that those were distinct separate acts, but that involved kidnapping, rape, assault, which happened not within about a 10-second period, but within about a 3-hour period. Well, I think this case is distinguishable from that, because we're talking about events that were put in motion that were over with in probably 10 or 15 seconds. Well, my argument is that there wasn't two collisions. There was one collision, one continuing collision, because Mr. Sandahl was being dragged under the car when Mr. Brown's car hit Mr. Zahn's car that was parked along the Walmart parking lot, that that collision was still going on. Where do you say that that ended? Did that end when he hit the bumper? Did it end when he went up on the hood? Did it end when he went under the car? Did it end as he was being dragged? Where did it end when the car stopped, when it was parked again, was up against Mr. Zahn's vehicle, pinned against the store?
So let's suppose that instead of running into Mr. Sandahl on foot, that your client instead ran into his car, and there were passengers in the car. Are you saying that the only person your client could be convicted of assaulting is the driver, Mr. Sandahl, and the passengers don't count?
Well, no, I think that, you know, each case is different, obviously. But if there are three people in a car and whoever the person is runs into that car, I think it's reasonable to believe, you know, if he's convicted of something, it's not going to be against one because there are three people in that one car for that one collision.
Well, I don't see the distinction, though. I mean, suppose you can't even see. Suppose it's a baby in the back seat and he can't see it. Still, either way, aren't we talking about a person having a criminal intent to injure and injuring more persons than maybe he intended to injure, but he still had the intent to do injury?
If they were attempting to injure someone in that car, correct. My argument is that he was not attempting, that Mr. Barano was not attempting to injure Mr. Zahn, that because it was with the speed of the car, the conditions, whatever, that he hit him, but he doesn't even have the minimal criminal intent necessary for aggravated assault on Mr. Zahn.
But, you know, in the absence of any testimony by him, how can we just wipe away the fact that, as the Assistant Attorney General says, there was an acceleration, there was no braking, there was no turning, no deviating from the line of traffic, but an acceleration. And, you know, are we supposed to take the video and overturn the jury verdict and say that's a separate and distinct act? I mean, it's not a separate and distinct act?
Well, very good question, Your Honor. My argument is that there was no distinct end, and that's what the Sealer case basically says. I mean, in the Sealer case, it was a three-hour period. My argument is that there wasn't a crime that was completed before the next act began, which is the language taken out of Sealer. So that's my argument.
If I recall Sealer, though, there was only one victim.
That's right.
And of course, we can't consider the fact that your client did not testify. Under the Fifth Amendment, he had the absolute right not to testify, and we can't use that against him in any way, can we?
That's correct, Your Honor, yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.